industrial sector is facing a defining moment. As policymakers work to accelerate the energy transition while strengthening competitiveness, energy-intensive industries are grappling with soaring energy costs, global competition, evolving trade policies, and the realities of decarbonization. To unpack these realities in more detail, I had the opportunity to speak with Paul Voss, Director General of European Aluminium. From the future of the EU ETS to the role of innovation and trade defence, Paul offers a refreshingly candid assessment of what's working, what isn't, and what Europe must do to ensure it can both decarbonise and retain a strong industrial base. I'm Pamela Larg, and this is the Energy Transitions Podcast. Paul, thank you so much for joining me today to talk about the policies that are helping or hindering European industry, specifically the aluminium sector. And when we were preparing for this podcast, you mentioned that sometimes you use various expletives to express yourself, especially when talking about challenges facing the sector, which I can understand. And clearly, there are some frustrations being felt. Speaking of frustration, perhaps we should start by talking about the EU ETS, the review of which is due. What are your thoughts, expectations, or unmet expectations of this mechanism?
It's become quite an ideological discussion involving a lot of people who probably don't understand all that well how the ETS works in detail. And I include myself among those people. I mean, there are real ETS experts, and then there are people like me, and it's different. In Brussels and in European capitals, the world is kind of dividing into ambitious, and I use the word, I put it in quotes, ambitious people who want an ETS that aggressively phases out free allocations and what's that word? Laggards. People keep talking about front runners versus laggards. And, you know, as always with these things, I think in real life, the debate's a bit more complicated than that. You have industries, depending on the technological state of things or the state of the technology in the industry, it's more or less easy to decarbonize. There are clearer pathways and less clear pathways. As, for example, the big part of our emissions are indirect. It's the electricity. So, okay, the decarbonization of the power grid is well underway. I think the last part will be the hardest part. So I suspect this journey will take longer than everyone perhaps like it to. But you can kind of see the direction of travel. And for us, we celebrate this. We encourage investment in renewables and in the grid. And probably, I don't know about new nuclear because it tends to be expensive and very, very slow to build. But certainly not keeping existing nuclear facilities running and get the most we can out of them because that's low carbon power. That's all great. For us on the installation side, the direct emissions, we know that the technologies that will be needed to decarbonize aluminium aren't coming in the short term. We sort of see what they are. There's a lot of work going on, innovation, research, pilot projects. But every time I talk to serious people who understand these things, they all sell me sort of, late 2030s if everything goes well. And so pressure to decarbonize those facilities in the meantime is completely meaningless to us. It's just it ends up feeling just like a fine. It's not a question of ambition or will or desire or intention or anything. It's just, it's not going to happen in the next 10 years. We know this. And it can be frustrating when you're told, oh, you should be more ambitious or you should be more of a front runner. Well, there are certain technological realities that we have to deal with and no amount of goodwill can overcome that. And so, I would like to see an ETS that is flexible enough to accommodate those realities without abandoning the entire project, because I can see the weather outside just like everybody else. There's no discussion about whether or not climate change is happening, and I think it would be really weird and irresponsible of us to say there's nothing to be done about it or it's not our problem. Of course it is, but I can't ask my industry to do the impossible. And they're all very, very motivated. Fully decarbonized aluminium for us is the holy grail. There's no lack of enthusiasm for getting it. But, the process is what it is. It will take years still. And I suspect more generally that a lot of assumptions, whether it's aluminium or any other major industrial sector, a lot of the assumptions that have been made about how decarbonization will go are probably going to be going to turn out to be overly optimistic, because all of us have been incentivized for years to make optimistic assumptions about what's going to happen because it was expected politically. So we've all generated these roadmaps and stories about how our decarbonization journey is going to go. And you're not encouraged to take a kind of cautious, conservative approach. You're incentivized to be very ambitious, and some might say to kind of suspend disbelief a little bit and just say, oh, well, maybe if all these things go incredibly well, this might happen. And then that goes from being one possible scenario to a forecast. And then we start building policy around those forecasts. And I worry sometimes that the whole thing is built on a lot of optimism. But we'll see.
You know, and I think this is the crux of the conversation. It's finding out from you, are policies really helping or hindering the sector and ultimately resulting in deindustrialization? So what are your thoughts on this? Give us a broad overview, focusing in especially on the aluminium sector.
Yeah. So look, the last 20 years have not been particularly kind to heavy industry in Europe generally. And in particular, the kind of 5 years between about 2020 and 2025 were pretty catastrophic for primary aluminium production in the European Union. We lost about half of our production due to a combination of high energy prices, I mean, uncompetitive energy prices. Aluminium is a global market. So it's not that you can just have a kind of self-contained European market where everyone's energy prices are high, so it doesn't matter. You're trading into a global market. And energy is competitiveness, and Europe's energy prices have been far too high compared to our large competitors around the globe. And that's been a massive problem. And aluminium in particular is so energy intensive, so electro intensive. If you don't have affordable energy, competitively priced energy, you're done. So we've seen massive curtailment of production in the last years. And then the other problem is at the same time, we are faced with increasing competition from other parts of the world, often based on what we would consider to be simply unfair conditions. And it's a particular issue with China: subsidies, overcapacity. And that's, you know, that combination is a killer. What I have found encouraging is that over the last, 18 months since current commission mandate started, we see really a shift, at least politically, rhetorically speaking, a shift towards much more discussion about the importance of retaining Europe's industrial base. And by definition, that means supporting European industry. The European Green Deal, which was the dominant organizing principle of the last commission mandate that went from 2019 to 2024, you know, it's a good thing. I mean, we can all celebrate the ambition of moving towards carbon neutrality and promoting renewable energy and so on. It's great. And there's no discussion about that. But I think, you know, there's pretty clear evidence that these years did not do much for the competitiveness of European industry. I think the problem is that underneath the idea of the European Green Deal was the assumption that the rest of the world would follow. And by extension, that Europe would establish leadership in these different clean energy technologies and benefit from a kind of first mover advantage. And so sell clean tech to China and the United States and India. None of that has really come to pass. I think it's fair to say there's been a political reckoning the last couple of years. The Draghi report and everything that came after it, saying, right, we need to think differently about these things. Without abandoning our ambitions to address climate change, we need to secure the future of industry in Europe. So that's all okay. And I think there are gestures towards trying to give us a more sustainable business environment, but it takes time. And in the meantime, I mean, we're still losing ground to China, to India, to the US, to Turkey. It's a challenging period. And I don't know. I mean, I think we'll see in the next 5, 6, 7, 8 years whether we're able to sort of turn this tendency around or not. We're not going to get to grips with it in 2045. I think we are in sort of now or never territory. I see it. You know, and if it were just aluminium, you could say, well, look, there's a structural issue with aluminium. It doesn't work. So we have to outsource it to some other part of the world. I mean, that's a, you could tell that story and you could look at the world that way if you wanted to. You know, we don't have to start from the point of view that preserving aluminium is the most important thing. But it's not just aluminium. You know, I was just on the phone with a colleague in steel. We see the same thing with chemicals, with glass, with all this basic stuff. And I think a civilization that's not able to make its own basic stuff is in trouble. And just as we became sensitive to our reliance on Russian gas over the last years, I think we're waking up to the idea that we should not become reliant on third countries or other regions for industrial production either, at least not completely reliant. I'm not suggesting that we cut off trade with the rest of the world, but we've got to be able to keep making stuff. And for that, you need certain conditions, chief among them, affordable energy and reasonable conditions in which to conduct international trade.
I mean, this is obviously the million-dollar question, as it were. How do we get that cheaper power to support industry? Because it seems, I mean, this is such a monumental task.
I don't think there's an easy answer. It's going to take time. It's going to take a lot of time and it's going to take a lot of money. So the long-term answer has to be a system that is much, much less reliant on fossil fuels. Part of the problem with the model now is even when we have lots of renewable electricity production, gas, you know, the price is set by the marginal unit. And that's typically gas. Maybe less and less, especially in certain areas. But basically, we're still working with an energy system where prices are set by gas. And as long as that's the case, you just don't have affordable energy in Europe. You know, we're structurally energy poor. And we used to kind of paper over that problem by importing loads and loads and loads of Russian gas. And obviously, the world has changed. We can't do that anymore. And I don't think we'll go back to doing that. And I don't think that we should. So the only alternative is a system much more based on renewables. There will be some nuclear, but we need a lot of renewable power. That means huge investments, not only in generation capacity, but in the grid. And then we need to make all that work because the dispatchable power that you get with coal or gas or whatever, that's easy. A system based on intermittent sources is completely different. So we have a lot of work to do on storage. I'm asked a lot about flexibility in the grid, demand response. Aluminium smelters are huge electricity customers with a certain potential to offer balancing services to the grid. But I think this is typically overstated and misunderstood by people who, you know, with perfectly good intentions, tell a story about, you can just turn the smelter on and off depending on when prices are high. You know, none of this works. You can do some peak shaving. You can drop consumption for minutes or an hour in some cases, and that can be useful. But you can't start turning things on and off. Otherwise, you destroy your facility in a real hurry. And that's not a question of being green or being in favor of such policies. Like, these are just technical engineering limitations. It reminds me, I mean, I was told by a friend in the summer of 2022, so I had just arrived in this business, and you'll remember that energy prices went completely crazy in that summer. And I was talking to a friend in the solar business who said to me, yeah, but this is your industry's fault. If you had just put solar panels on your roof before, you'd be fine. And I mean, I'm never going to tell people who that was because they'd be embarrassed, because it's embarrassing, because it completely fails to take account of the scale of the consumption that's required to run an aluminium smelter. You know, all our facilities have solar panels on the roof, and those do a great job of powering the office. So you can run your computers and make the tea. There's a large aluminium smelter, the largest in the European Union, in Dunkirk. And right next to it is a nuclear power plant. And half of that power is to run the city of Dunkirk, and the other half of the power is for the aluminium smelter. So a few panels on the roof really doesn't touch the sides. And so it's not, it reminds me a little bit of when people start talking about, you know, I think there can be a tendency to put excessive pressure on individual citizens to solve the climate problem, the problem of the energy transition. You know, it's great. I have solar panels on my roof. I'm happy to do that. I think it's a good thing. I'm happy that my neighbors see it and then they ask me and they get some solar panels and it's great. But these are big structural problems. And as individual actors, we are somewhat limited in our ability to address them. You know, they need to be a whole suite of things. First and foremost, public money and public policy. And then, I mean, we try and play our part. But to give you a short answer, I don't think there's an easy way to get cheap power into Europe in the short term. What we have to do is invest and plan relentlessly and plan for the long term, not for the next quarter or the next election, but for a long-term horizon like 2040, 2050. And in the meantime, there are going to have to be thoughtful use of public money, subsidies, to make this work. You know, decarbonization is a kind of public good, and to an extent, those costs are going to have to be socialized. If you leave it to individual actors to make these investments, and then there's no business case, they won't be able to do it, and they will shut down, and that production will mechanically reappear in other parts of the world. And I don't think anybody wants that, not economically, not politically, not socially.
Paul, I love how you don't mince your words, and you just tell us the realities, the nitty-gritties of what it's like on the ground. And I think that's what makes these conversations so important, because it helps to generate awareness of the real scale of the challenge. As you say, a few solar panels on a roof ain't going to cut it. But now that we've got an idea of the challenge, I do want to ask you specifically about some of the, you know, obviously geopolitically, there's a lot going on. There's been a lot of, global competition that's come to the fore, sanctions, export tariffs. How has this influenced the sector?
You know, so I have this tiny dog, and I have an enormous dog. And they generally get along pretty well, but every now and then I find the tiny dog somewhere, and I can see that she's, the big one has basically picked him up, chewed on him for a bit, and spit him out. And I'll find him kind of lying somewhere, just trying to breathe and pull himself together again. And there are days when I feel a certain kinship with him. You know, we are not in a position to dictate too much of what goes on the global stage. The geopolitics are what they are. Things have gone completely crazy the last few years. And aluminium inevitably is immediately and severely impacted by these things. So, I mean, I find myself getting phone calls saying, what are you going to do about Trump, you know, and his tariffs? Well, nothing. I mean, you know, what am I going to do? And I've had this, you know, what are you going to do about the conflict in the Middle East? Well, nothing, you know, and Europe's not going to do much about it either. I mean, Europe will issue statements calling for calm on all sides. Europe will deplore the escalation of violence, but we're not in charge. And Europe, I think, at times doesn't even get a seat at the table these days. So we are affected by these things. Fortunately, I think to some extent, we are also in a position to exert some influence. And I mean, I can cite a couple of examples. You know, when the war started, the full-scale invasion of Ukraine in 22, the European Commission called after some days while they were trying to sort of get their bearings and figure out what all this meant for different aspects of the European economy. And one of the questions was, what about aluminium? Can we stop importing Russian aluminium? Now, at the time, Russia accounted for, I think, a quarter of the EU's aluminium exports. We had a lot of discussion about the idea that things should be sanctioned if they would hurt Russian interests more than European ones. But at the time, the industry here wasn't ready to cut off contact with Russia because the supply chain was full of Russian metal and there were contracts and just a physical need for supply. I remember talking to my board and saying, look, the writing is kind of on the wall here. You should be planning to diversify your suppliers. You should not plan for a long-term future where you remain dependent on Russian metal. And to be fair, I mean, the industry, I think, reacted with all things considered, a surprising degree of agility, such that after a year or so, I was able to go back to the commission and say, okay, now we could cope. And actually, it would be a good thing, because why should we continue to send several billion euros a year to Russia if we don't need to? And after a lot of discussion and negotiation, Russian aluminium was banned. So you can't export primary aluminium or any other type of aluminium really from Russia to the European Union anymore. And that's something that we did. And I think it was morally the right thing to do. I mean, it was deeply uncomfortable for me that we were just continuing to buy this stuff if we didn't need to. And second, I mean, frankly, it's been good for business. And why should money go to Russian suppliers when it can go to European ones? Similarly, you know, you want to discuss the issue of scrap export and export duties now, or we can do it later, but...
Yes, I would actually like to delve into the issue of scrap, because in the past, significant volumes of aluminium scrap have left the region.
Over the last couple of years, I started to get more and more urgent messages from the industry that scrap prices in Europe are getting out of control. And that is because other actors, China with subsidies and overcapacity, I mean, the usual, was in a position to pay much, much more for scrap than a European player could. Same in India, same in other parts of the world. Buyers of European scrap ready to pay more than Europeans could, but because we're not functioning within the same market, within the same conditions. And we made the case to the EU that this was detrimental to Europe's ambitions on circular economy, on decarbonization, and on self-sufficiency more generally. And after, you know, that was a big ask. The EU has never applied export duties before on anything. This is really fundamentally new approach to some, I mean, I think it still falls within the broad category of trade defense, but it's a completely novel instrument. And so understandably, they were cautious and there was a lot of work done on sketching out what a mechanism to do that might look like, the legal basis, the practical parameters of the thing, how to dimension it properly so that it was proportionate, so that it did the job that we needed to do without stopping any and all trade in the scrap business, which I think would have been too much. And I think we're more or less there. So it's 6-8 weeks away now. On September 23rd, the EU is set to publish new legislation on or designed to limit the export of aluminium scrap from the European Union. And this would have been unthinkable a couple of years ago. And I think the shocks that we've had in geopolitics have been useful in that one sense, that they've taught Europe that it can and probably needs to consider things that it wouldn't have before, that the unthinkable becomes, for lack of a better word, thinkable.
Speaking of kind of making the unthinkable thinkable, which I think should be a new phrase, do you believe, Paul, that innovation is still going to play a pivotal role in perhaps setting European industry apart and making it more competitive? Is there space for that? Is that more of a kind of blue sky thinking?
Well, I think we'd better because, you know, other parts of the world are innovating. You know, it's I think sometimes there's a tendency to sort of sit here in Europe and think about how wonderful and virtuous we all are. And there are some outdated and frankly lazy stereotypes about China, for example, dirty, old-fashioned, but it's bullshit, it's rubbish. It's not what we see. They are moving very, very quickly. You see it in their use of robots, their use of AI, their use of, I mean, there are factories in China now where there's just kind of one person to open the gate and that's about it. They don't even have lights anymore. They don't need them because the machines are so busy working. And so, I mean, we had better get our act together. Like it's the idea that Europe is the technological pinnacle of the world. I mean, I think that's gone. Yes, innovation, not only with respect to decarbonization, but just better, more efficient production techniques, absolutely indispensable if we want to remain competitive, we want to even try to remain competitiveness. The pressure is huge. And just sort of sitting back and telling ourselves how great European technology is, how wonderful it all was in the 90s is not going to help us. Our competitors are serious. So must we be. And it's not, you know, I think a degree of trade defense that kind of levels the playing field so that we can compete on an equal footing, it's okay. But we do have to be careful not to stray into a place where we are protecting ourselves against legitimate competition. We also have to keep getting better. And those signals that tell us that we need to keep getting better, those are useful. And we shouldn't protect ourselves to the point where we can't hear them anymore, because that long term, I don't think it's going to help us. We have to get better.
If you could see three policy changes happen in the near future that you believe would really make a difference, a tangible difference to Europe's aluminium sector, what would they be?
Number one is, in one way or another, get us access to energy at a competitive price. I don't necessarily say cheap energy, but competitive, affordable prices for industry. And that means, on one hand, you know, anything that can be done, as I said earlier, to shift us on to a model based more on renewables, but a model that works. And then the other is a kind of judicious use of state aid. I know there's a problem with state aid, and we can't, it's a bit the same thing. We don't want to throw so much public money at things that we dampen market signals. But at the same time, one way or another, industry needs affordable, competitively priced energy. That's it. So that's one. Second, I think on trade defense, and I kind of feel it coming now, but the EU needs to become much, much more hawkish when it comes to defending its interests. The EU has done very well out of free trade over the last 50 years, but the world has changed. And now a belief in that model where markets are as open as possible and Europe does well by exporting its high tech to the other parts of the planet. I think that model is dying or dead. So we'll need to be more aggressive on protecting our markets from what we consider to be unfair competition without, as I say, it spilling over into just protecting ourselves from everything so that we become fat and lazy. And third, carry on with the energy transition, but manage the costs for industry such that we don't disappear. Because, you know, what is very frustrating is to see our industry hollowed out here and then that same capacity mechanically popping up in China or other parts of the world. You know, with aluminium, we know that there's going to be a demand for the product. There's no question about whether Europeans are going to use a lot of aluminium or not in the future. The only question is whether we continue to make it here or not. And I think we'd have every interest in finding a way to make sure that we do.
And now my final question to you, Paul. You compared yourself to a small chewed up dog earlier. And for our listeners, I can confirm that that does not seem to be the case. In fact, you come across more as a tenacious bulldog. And I mean that as a compliment. What keeps you going? What keeps you motivated? And what keeps you seemingly quite passionate about the work that you do?
Yeah, well, thanks. You know something, I really love the people I work with. So the companies that we represent, the colleagues I have here, we have the most fantastic team here in my organization in Brussels. I feel a huge responsibility to help protect this industry. I think that they deserve a chance to grow and to develop. They've been under enormous pressure these last years. And I find them to be, as people and as organizations, really determined and resilient. And I think, you know, the least I can do is show up for them and speak for them. You know, that's our job here, to give them a voice. And so it's easy to get out of bed for that.
Paul, what a pleasure it has been to speak with you. I feel like we could go on for hours, but we don't have hours. But what we have, the time that we've had has been amazing. Thank you so much for joining me.
Pleasure was mine, Pamela. Thank you.
And to all of our listeners, until next time, goodbye. Thank you for listening to this episode of the Energy Transitions Podcast, brought to you by Enlit and Friends. That's a wrap from me, Pamela Larg, and our producer, Rian Mostert. We hope you can join us next time. Visit enlit.world or subscribe for more episodes.